now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. Very excited to be with you here every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you'd like to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to join me in the conversation tonight, here's the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break. And just in case you cannot spend the full hour with me this evening, these broadcasts are also podcasted. In case you'd want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And they are now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. And you can also listen on Station One to iHeartRadio. So, for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, I just wanted to say welcome aboard and welcome to the show. Each and every broadcast here is dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And a lot of people think that the two disciplines are mutually exclusive, but they are not. They have just a wonderful integration if we ask the right questions, or if we dig deeper, let's say, so to speak, or if we are paying attention and there are signs all around us, and just how do we integrate our spirituality and our mental health on a daily basis. So again, for those of you who are new to the program, I just want to say that I'm a firm believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything we need for in this life in terms of our giftedness or our skills, our talents, our strengths, character traits, so on and so forth. And yet, sometimes as we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may tend to hide our giftedness. You know, we push it way down so that others cannot see it, because perhaps we've gotten burned by that, or somebody exploited our skills or our talents, or whatever. Or perhaps, you know, we were told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. All lies. And at any rate, we do not realize our giftedness, our skills, our talents, and our strengths. And we often go through life then functioning from a place of woundedness, instead of a place of healing, instead of a place of wholeness, and a chaitas, or a uniqueness. This is what I usually end up explaining to kids that I counsel, that we all have a uniqueness, and they like the word hachetas. They think it's cool. They keep saying that. But it's kind of like a thumbprint, you know, our uniqueness, that everybody has a thumbprint, but no two thumbprints are the same. You know, and this is what's, you know, cool about our uniqueness, our hachetas. We all have a uniqueness, but no two are alike. And we go through life, and whatever we do, however we are in our relationships and so forth, we do so from a place of uniqueness. So in other words, let's just, oh, I don't know, just pick a career. Let's say that somebody's in the restaurant business, okay, and a cook or waiter, waitress, a host, hostess, whatever, but they do that according to their uniqueness. So let's say that the head waiter is named Tony, and Tony, does his, just being a head waiter according to Tony-ness, his uniqueness, that other people could do the job of a host or a hostess, but they can't do it like him, or they can't do it like her. And so that's what makes it unique, that everybody has this hachetas to them. And we just never bother going about finding what is that uniqueness about it, and celebrating that. And then how do we put this into practice? How do we live this out on a daily basis? Well, I get asked all the time, how exactly do we reclaim our authenticity? And, certainly reclaiming that which you have always had and always been, it does take great courage, and it takes a lot of inner strength to change from what is known and comfortable, the things that we've gotten used to in our lives, to something that's fresh and new. It involves letting go and a taking on simultaneously, and it does take great courage to be able to do this, because quite often it involves working through issues of forgiveness, ingratitude or lack of gratitude, and disgust or hatred towards ourselves and others. And a lot of people I counsel struggle with this self-loathing, that they, for one reason or another, just simply cannot forgive themselves for a time way back when, or they can't forgive somebody else for a time way back when. But when you think about it, that which is unknown to us often contains our greatest potential for change. And to seek our highest potential by risking change, that's the path of true greatness, because such action brings great favor and untold blessings, especially through the most unlikely people, in the most unlikely places, and in the most unlikely times. But unfortunately, we often do not see courage in ourselves because we want to hang on to the past, or perhaps we can't imagine something better in our lives, let alone discovering who we really are. So in tonight's broadcast, I'm using courage as the strength we possess that empowers us to let go of negative attitudes and distorted perceptions that no longer serve us. Those negative attitudes and distorted perceptions that keep us wounded or in a place of being victimized, and then taking on something better, something more life-giving, more authentic to who we truly are and who we have always been. Or, as my teacher puts it, until there is an acknowledgement of our spiritual nature, we're not going to do the work that's necessary to eradicate the ignorance that keeps us bound. In fact, we will continue to experience the changing joys and sorrows associated with the temporary and the false states of consciousness. And then we will seek gratifying pleasures that only seek to soothe our sorrows. So it does take tremendous, tremendous courage to look within, which, by the way, always brings us back to how we're nurturing our relationships in terms of forgiveness, gratitude, and love. And ironically, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual wounds in relationships. And yet, we can discover our greatest healing, our strength, our peace, forgiveness, and love through healthier relationships. In fact, there's so much more to us than what we have become so far. And that's what reclaiming authenticity is all about. Having this courage to reclaim that which has always been in you and that which you are. So basically, these broadcasts, as I said, focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and the relationship that we have with God or the divine. So indeed, it is my great pleasure to be with you here tonight. And I hope that wherever you are today, that you're safe and that you are at peace, especially your heart is at peace. And as I mentioned, I'll be taking your calls after the break because I really would like to hear from you on today's subject. Where did Kansas go, Dorothy? The psychological, emotional, physical, and spiritual lessons learned from near-death experiences. Now, near-death experiences have been encountered for centuries upon centuries upon centuries. And today, whenever the topic of near-death experiences come up, people are all ears. They want to hear all about the stories. What did you see? What did you hear? What was it like? And so forth. So let's start at the very beginning. What exactly is a near-death experience? Well, pretty much, near-death experience is a very distinct phenomenon that people sometimes report. Sometimes. Not all the times, but sometimes. People report after a near-death episode. And in a near-death episode, a person is either pronounced clinically dead, or they're near death, or in a situation where death is likely or it's expected. And these circumstances around this could, you know, include serious illness or injury, let's say from a car accident or a cardiac arrest or a military combat or childbirth or a suicide attempt and so forth, and whereby the heart stops beating. And it has been reported that near-death experiences occur all within, let's say, 1 minute to 4 or 5 minutes of a person's heart stopping. But yet, the person is resuscitated. Some people report having sensed various images and sounds, etc., while dead. Now, most people are familiar with Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life. This has been around for a long time. I think it came out initially in 1975. It's still a great read because he was the first one that I would say really wrote a book in which he put exactly what is a near-death experience into everyday common language. And I like the title, Life After Life. So he's already starting to redefine what a near-death experience is. He's looking at it as a transition, but it's, again, what people experience when they've been pronounced clinically dead, but then resuscitated. And, you know, perhaps more recently, many people have seen the movie Heaven is for Real. And I think that came out in 2014. Heaven is for Real, where a young boy had a near-death experience. And it's kind of interesting that his family went through tremendous difficulty trying to explain their son's experience to others in a small town in which they were just flat out skeptical. And all the boy wanted to do is just, I want to tell you what I seen. I want to tell you what I heard. I want to tell you what it means to me and what it could mean in your life. Well, on October 27th of this year, just a few weeks ago, Angel Studios released the movie After Death, a movie that focuses on near-death experiences. And people have been fascinated by all of the stories and firsthand encounters that people had to share who were once pronounced clinically dead, then resuscitated. Well, in Moody's book, Life After Life, he describes a near-death experience occurring when a person has, as he puts it, medically crossed the threshold of death, but then they're brought back to life using, you know, the intervention of medical technology, and they regain their consciousness, let's say. And since writing his book, there have been many more personal accounts of near-death experiences simply because we have more life resuscitation devices available to us. In fact, there seems to be, you know, more automated electronic defibrillators or AEDs in public places. You know, maybe you've seen them in restaurants or theaters, or even at your church or a synagogue or a mall or a mosque or a department store. And more people are being trained in CPR, so not just people who work in the medical field, but, you know, grandparents want to be trained in CPR for, you know, just in case their grandkids might need it and vice versa and so forth. So just by sheer advancement of medical technology, more and more people are being resuscitated after their hearts have stopped. And many, many people are reporting having near-death experiences. Now, Moody's book is not the first time anyone has ever recorded a near-death experience. There was actually one ancient near-death experience that was recorded. Because there's actually an ancient account told by the philosopher Socrates, incorporated into Plato's Republic. Maybe you had to read that at school at some point. And Socrates related the fate of a warrior called the son of Arminius, who was left for dead on the battlefield, but unexpectedly returned to life at the instant he was placed on the funeral pyre. He writes that he was slain in battle, and 10 days afterwards, when the bodies of the dead were taken up already in a state of corruption, his body was found unaffected by decay and carried away home to be buried. And on the 12th day, as he was lying on his funeral pile, he returned to life and told everyone what he had seen in the other world. He said that when his soul left the body, he went on a journey with a great company. And then they came to a mysterious place at which there were two openings in the earth, and they were near together, and over and against them were two other openings in heaven above, and so on and so forth. Well, there have been many philosophers and scholars out there who dispute the facts about Ur's experience as being, well, it just simply was an allegory. It was a fictional story. Yet it offers striking parallels to modern near-death experience accounts that have been reported by thousands, if not millions, of people all around the world. And today, modern researchers are taking a new look at Ur's account by Plato. And the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation uses a scale to measure the depth and intensity of an individual's near-death experience. And they list that the characteristics of near-death experiences include a sense of being dead, having pleasant feelings or a calmness, a sense of overwhelming love and peace, having an out-of-body experience or sensing floating above one's body and seeing the surrounding areas, a sensation of moving upwards through a tunnel or a narrow passageway, and in this tunnel, meeting deceased relatives or even spiritual figures, and then encountering a being of light, possibly a religious or a divine figure, or being engulfed in a warm light. Many report experiencing their life review. And that's very important. I'm going to come back to that one. Okay, so the life review. And then reaching a border or a boundary in which they can go no further. And a lot of people report just having a silver cord, you know, around them and attached to another area that keeps them from going forward. And then a feeling of being returned to the body, often accompanied by, let's say, reluctance or a choice. It's now not your time. Will you agree to go back? And then when a person says yes, they're back. Now, not all near-death experiences follow this criterion verbatim. In fact, for approximately 15% of near-death experiencers, the passage through the dark tunnel is a frightening experience. And for example, one man shared his story. He says, "I suddenly stopped in this dark tunnel. and I began to fall down at an enormous speed, faster and faster and faster, as if I was literally hurled down vertically with my head downwards into this black hole. It was so pitch black, I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. And while I was falling like that, I began to hear screaming, shrieks, heartrending, horrible, horrible laughter, and the most revolting stench you can imagine. And then the black environment changed to fire, and there were all sorts of terrible-looking and frightening creatures. And then at that point, he was resuscitated. But still, the majority of near-death experiences involve positive, loving, and pleasant feelings and experiences. And for many, many people, they're drawn to these near-death experience stories simply because, well, perhaps maybe they're just interested in the details instead of really listening and in listening to the overarching lessons and life changes that resulted from having a near-death experience. Now, at this point, I'm going to have to add a word of caution here, because many people are drawn to these stories of near-death experiences out of, let's say, curiosity or fascination, and perhaps some people would then conclude that since what near-death experiencers report is so beautiful and peaceful and filled with unconditional love, why then stay on this earth any longer? Why not commit suicide and go straight to heaven and live these wonderful experiences? Well, that's not a good idea. This is a huge misunderstanding about what near-death experiences are all about. Because back in 2006, there was a movie entitled The Bridge. It came out on DVD, and filmmakers used hidden cameras to capture various suicide attempts at the Golden Gate Bridge. The world's still, I would say, the world's most popular suicide destination. And interviews with the victims' loved ones described their lives and the mental health of those who had jumped off the bridge. And in other accounts, some survivors of the suicide, of their suicide attempt, reported that during their near-death experience, they were allowed to go on a little bit further and to see and feel the devastating effects their suicide had on families, their families. And for the first time in their lives, they realized how much they were loved and cared for by many, many people. And as a result, they had lost any desire to hasten their deaths. In fact, a lot of people just did a complete 180-degree turn from being filled with despair and hopelessness to now being filled with love and value and cherished every relationship in their lives. And this is exactly where my interest with near-death experiences come in. Namely, how has your life been transformed? As a result of your near-death experience, what lessons have you learned? How has your experience awakened you to who you really are, your authentic self? And perhaps more importantly, what lessons can the rest of humanity learn from you so that they can live more authentically? Well, Dr. Kenneth Ring, he was a co-founder of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and he pointed out that there are specific lessons the rest of humanity can learn from the near-death experiencers, specific lessons that everybody can integrate into their lives as long as we are able to make shifts in our awareness and daily living. In other words, are people committed to integrating how do I live out such a beautiful experience? Well, here are the lasting changes in values and beliefs. People appreciate life more fully, and they have no more fear of death. people experience increased feelings of self-worth, self-acceptance. People have more compassionate regard for others and more compassionate regard for all of life. They feel a connectedness. They develop a heightened ecological sensitivity. They are definitely anti-materialism and anti-competitiveness. And one's religious orientation becomes more universalistic, more inclusive and spiritual in its expression. In other words, focusing on what all people have in common. Some people from a near-death experience have, with the lasting change in their values and beliefs, have just an unquenchable thirst for knowledge or a sense of purpose serving others. Or they're definitely convinced of life after the physical death of the body. And they're absolutely convinced of the existence of God or the divine. I mean, you're not talking them out of that one at all, because it goes from, well, I believe there was a God, I hope there's a God, to now I know there's a God. I am convinced there is a God. There is the divine. And some people develop gifts of healing or heightened intuition or even ESP. And some people develop unusual sensitivity toward light or sound, or they may become very sensitive to humidity or other environmental stimuli. Some people start to become more sensitive to allergies, or some people have this diminished tolerance to alcohol or pharmaceutical drugs. They just, I can't drink anymore. I don't have the taste for it. I do not have the desire to take any kind of drugs. And some people, they experience a tremendous shift in their energy, where they have more energy, or they might sleep less, and so forth. But this 180-degree turn, this transformation, doesn't necessarily involve, I mean, there's no guarantee here, a smooth, seamless transition. From I was in this accident, I was pronounced dead, I had this near-death experience, I was resuscitated, and now it's all good. No more worries, no more cares, and I can live this out perfectly. That doesn't necessarily happen. And I'm going to share with you after the break a study that identifies 6 major challenges faced by near-death experiencers. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on this matter. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. So far in the first half of the show, we've been talking about the characteristics of near-death experiences, that when a person was either dead, pronounced dead, or as a result of their heart stopping, or a sense of being dead, and then The person experienced a sense of pleasant feelings, calmness, a sense of overwhelming love and peace, an out-of-body experience, a sensation of floating above one's body and seeing the surrounding area. Some people report a sensation of moving upwards through a tunnel or a narrow passageway. Or in that tunnel or narrow passageway, they met deceased relatives or spiritual figures. And they encountered a being of light, maybe a religious or a divine figure, or being engulfed in a very warm light. And they experienced their life review. As I said at the first half of the show, I'm going to say more about that here coming up. They experienced their life review. And a lot of people report having a silver cord, let's say, around their waist that tethers them to the earth. And they can only go so far, you know, because they've reached a border or a boundary. And then a feeling of being returned to their body, often accompanied by reluctance, or they were given a choice. As soon as, you know, if they're told, like, you know, now's not your time, go back, there are more important things for you to do, boom. And once they say, okay, and then they're back, you know, even before they get the words out. Once they have that feeling of like, okay, you know, next thing they know, they're being resuscitated and they wake up. Now, as I said in the first half of the show, with experiencing all these wonderful things in a near-death experience, it doesn't necessarily guarantee a smooth, seamless transition after the near-death experience. I mean, at some point you get up and go, you know, not right away, but you get to leave the hospital, you get back to your life and so forth, and you know, a lot of people, they don't have it all that easy afterwards. You know, they think about it this way. They have a life-changing experience. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And then they report things like experiencing headaches and migraines. They have an increase in their anxiety and depressive symptoms. They may even report traumatic experiences or you know, just dreams that they're not aware of. And some people in, you know, who have died in car accidents and been resuscitated, they're now facing months, if not, you know, a couple of years in a rehab. Or some are now sent back and they are paraplegic or quadriplegic. You know, and then just trying to make sense of what happened here. I thought things would be different. And I fell into this category too, because I was under the impression that once having a near-death experience, everything should be smooth sailing and person should be able to attain higher vibrational attunements. Well, again, as I mentioned, there was an article, actually a research study that came out called The Six Major Challenges Faced by Near-Death Experiencers. And the authors are Stout, Jacquin, and Atwater. And this was done way back in 2006. And their conclusion in the people that they had interviewed, the average time to adjust to a near-death experience was somewhere between 12.7 to 42 years. And that's just the average time to adjust to your near-death experience. So what is it? What prevents like a smooth transition here and takes people decades, let's say, at least up to 12 years on average, maybe some 10, somewhere around there. But it takes them many, many years just to come to terms with what happened. Well, one of the major challenges is that people who have had a near-death experience, they're processing this radical shift in their reality. You know, there's a new concept of life and death and afterlife and body, mind, and spirit. And they have a new view of the self. They have a new view of others. There is a total realignment of one's priorities. The next major challenge is that people are often torn between being having sent back here to accepting the return, a yearning to return, a feeling of homesick, that I want to go back to what I felt. I want to be engulfed in a warm, bright light. I want to be surrounded by unconditional love because I come back here and all I see in traffic is people yelling and screaming and about a lot of hatred, and I don't see a lot of unconditional love. The third challenge of what near-death experiencers face is sharing the experience. You know, they want to be believed. They need to be accepted as well as to process and understand what happened. And so, as I said, a lot of people are just, you know, they're all ears when somebody says, I just want to share my story about a near-death experience. And they want to, what did you see? What did you hear? How do you know this was real? And so on and so forth, when the person is like, trust me, I was there. This was real. This is real. And so forth. And the fourth major challenge is integrating new spiritual values with everyday earthly experiences, you know, such as the importance of unconditional love and how we treat one another. And how do we integrate this? Again, with a lot of times, especially in the world in which we live today, not a lot of peace is going on. Not a lot of peace. I am not even talking about war, just not a lot of peace in people's hearts and in their homes and their workplaces and so on and so forth. And then there's also adjusting to heightened sensitivities and even supernatural gifts, you know, being sensitive to strong emotions or negative behaviors and very heightened sense of intuition or more acutely aware of things such as smells and vision and taste and sounds and so forth. And lastly, finding and living one's purpose. Not just struggling with why was I sent back, but what's the reason for it? What am I to do? Where am I to do it? How am I to do this? So as I said, having a near-death experience doesn't necessarily guarantee a smooth, seamless transition into living, you know, that experience out in this world. And there are many clinical problems associated with near-death experiences. And despite, you know, the generally positive outcomes, there's significant intrapsychic and interpersonal difficulties that frequently arise in the wake of a near-death experience. And this has to be the one aspect that bring people to me as a result of their near-death experiences. How do I now live this out? Because you see, a lot of people might have ongoing anger or depression related to losing the near-death experience, not the memory of it, but being sent back. Now what do I do? I was sent back, so I had to do all this rehab, and I can't walk right, I can't walk at all, or I have, you know, I have no motivation to do things I used to do, and my friends don't get me, and I can't hang out with them because I'm just not into that anymore. I don't gamble anymore. I don't care about what other people are interested in. You know, a total realignment of one's priorities. And they often have difficulty reconciling their near-death experience with previous religious beliefs, values, and even their lifestyle. I mean, where does my experience fit in with my religious beliefs? And a lot of people struggle with becoming overly identified with the experience. In fact, the people I talk to, they just like, hey, this plays over in my mind again and again and again every day. And, you know, there's also this fear the near-death experience might indicate, or it might be perceived as, mental instability. well, you know, I just don't know if all these things are true. If you're saying you might be delusional. And yet the person is saying, I was there. This happened. I am not crazy. I am not mentally unstable. I might be angry. I might struggle with some anxiety and depressive moods, but I am not unstable. And then there's also interpersonal difficulties, you know, difficulty reconciling changes with your attitudes or assumptions and perspectives with the expectations of family and friends. You know, a lot of people sense, you know, isolation from those who have not had a similar experience, you know, because people, and this is no fault to them, but people just do not understand, you know, or there might even be a fear of being ridiculed or rejected from others because, like, okay, there she goes again on this story. There also might be difficulty communicating the meaning and impact of a near-death experience. So, okay, let's say you had this near-death experience and everything was wonderful and great, but you're back home now. So what are you going to do with all this? And again, the people who've had a genuine near-death experience struggle with, they want to find the meaning and the impact of what they had experienced. And there's also difficulty maintaining previous life roles that no longer carry the same significance. Or difficulty reconciling limited human relationships with the unconditional relationships experienced during the near-death experience. So in other words, being engulfed in this bright warmth light and being surrounded by unconditional love. And then you're in relationships, you're sent back and you're in a relationship with, say, a significant other, a spouse, fiance, other family members who place a lot of conditional expectations on you to earn your love, let's say, for lack of a better phrase. Now, despite these near-death experiences, there's also many people in the scientific community who dispute such claims, saying that, well, what a person experienced was merely the result of the brain losing oxygen and dying. Not all the sights and sounds were the result of the dying brain releasing chemicals that produced such experiences. Or there have been people that I've met who believe that they can induce a near-death experience simply by taking certain hallucinogens, magic mushrooms, even ketamine, which, if you're not familiar with ketamine, it's a large animal horse tranquilizer. I'll just put it that way. And I had one young man, this is decades ago, who experimented with ketamine. I'm not going to say how he got it, but he didn't really tell me how he got it. I have my own theories, but he experimented with ketamine. And he said that he would take just enough whereby his respiration was brought down to what he called the threshold of death. And he saw what he believed to be some of the characteristics of a genuine near-death experience. And he said that he had done this several times. And so I asked him, I said, okay, how then is your life different? What has transformed in you? How do you treat yourself and others now after having these experiences? And sadly, he didn't have an answer. In fact, as far as I could tell, his life was just the same as it was before. And herein lies the main difference between people who had a genuine near-death experience and those who had an artificial one manipulated by drugs. And this is the life review. The life review, where a person reports seeing, hearing, and feeling everything that has ever been done or said to them, as well as seeing, hearing, and feeling everything that they have ever done or said to others. This is the life review. And it all happens, let's say, within 2 minutes or 3 minutes, or however long the person is dead or trying to be resuscitated. Okay? They experience everything that has been done to them or said to them, as well as everything that they have done or said to others. And this could be positive or negative. This could be very loving comments. This could be very hateful comments. This could be, you know, anything. Just very, very, just rapid fire of going through this life review. And the person, this is what I believe creates this 180 degree turn in people, that they come out of it, they're resuscitated, I should say, and they realize just how connected everybody is to one another and the wounds that they had carried from everything that had been done or said to them, or everything that they have done or said to others. And they don't want to hurt other people anymore. They're very mindful, no pun intended, but they're very mindful of their thoughts, very mindful of their words, very mindful of their actions. And this all comes about through their life review. Because you see, after a person comes out of a drug-induced, artificial, whatever, their life goes back to normal. And so after a person who's had a genuine near-death experience as a result of a death, they return never to be the same again. There's a total, total life change. Well, the last part about near-death experiences I want to share with everybody tonight is, how do children report near-death experiences? There's actually a pretty cool movie out there. It's, I forget how many years ago it was made. It's called Dragonfly. And of course, you know, Hollywood gets in there and does its own thing. But again, it has a nice storyline to it. I won't ruin it for you. But there are a couple children who, you know, talk about their near-death experiences. And, you know, this has the interest of, I think, Kevin Costner is one of the stars in the movie. And so he interviews them. And I think he also interviews a nun who's recorded many of these near-death experiences from the kids. And so, again, in just a simple ranking of the order of most frequently encountered, children often describe their near-death experiences as, you know, seeing light beings or bright ones. And kids, you know, would generally call them, well, I saw the people. Or they report, you know, I saw angels with or without wings. And the angels could be white, could be dressed in all black, and or of various skin hues. And they often report running into deceased loved ones, including relatives that they have never met or known about before, who are then later verified by other family members. Or maybe they've run into a favorite pet or zoo animals who had died. And they often talk about God or the presence of God or hearing God's voice. And it's, you know, seldom given a gender by adults, and described as an older male by children. You know, they say, well, that was God's voice, definitely. And Dr. Phyllis Marie Atwater, a researcher who has collected hundreds of cases on childhood near-death experiences, says that, unfortunately, some have tried to commit suicide afterwards in order to find their way back to their blissful visions. But these cases are very, very rare. And usually children who experience near-death experiences report being given the option of returning to life, and they decide to take it because they don't want to upset their parents and their grandparents. And Dr. Atwater writes in one of her accounts, she writes, as an intensive care nurse who has also done a PhD on near-death experiences, I've personally come across many such cases. If a child is a bit older, though, he may also say that he felt the need to return to Earth in order to accomplish something in this life. And this is what happened to Natasha, age 13, who is deaf. And at the age of 9, she had such a severe bout of whooping cough that the doctor had told her parents that she was unlikely to survive the night. And so she was home and fast asleep when she was woken by a bright light. She says, "The light was spilling into the room around the edge of the door, and I could hear my name being called, even though I am profoundly deaf. I got up to see what the light was and turned around to see myself still in the bed, asleep. But the voice kept calling me, so I opened the bedroom door, and it was just this pure, brilliant white light. I stepped into it and kept walking towards the voice. I was just walking in light. There wasn't anything else. And then I was in a room and realized there was a presence behind me. And he put a hand on my shoulder, but told me not to turn around. I had to go back, he said, because I was important and I had a job to do." Well, the next day, the crisis in Natasha's illness had passed. But she didn't tell anyone about her experience for years, because I thought they'd think I was lying or crazy. Well, and this has to be where people who have had near-death experiences struggle the most, telling their stories. And yet, telling their stories brings about great healing. I'm Dr. James Houck, and I want to thank you for spending this hour with me. Again, if you had a near-death experience, I hope what was shared here tonight will give you some comfort and some direction in how do I go about living out what I have seen and heard. And for those of you who may not have had a near-death experience but tuned in to hear the stories and the research being done, I just invite you to go on that website, the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, or the International Association for Near-Death Studies. Both will get you there. Both have lots of stories of people, firsthand accounts and so forth, as well as research that has been done. And so, again, thank you for spending this hour with me. So I will talk to everybody in 2 weeks, but until that time, everybody be safe, everybody behave themselves, and everybody take care. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.